All right, we're recorded now, so everybody behave. All right, couple things. Welcome and happy birthday. I give you a bookmark. It has our website. We have podcasts you can listen to. This meeting, we go through the book. We're at the book with three different parts of the book at the three different meetings. And today we're finishing Doctor's Opinion, Bill's story. On Sunday night, we are finishing the fourth step. But tomorrow night on Christmas Eve, I have a special meeting planned where we're going to look at the gifts of the 12 steps. And I'm going to look at some of the passages in the book that show the powerful gifts we get from doing the steps. And so if you can join us at 6. On Wednesday night, we are on step 11. And we finished reading the instructions in the book, and we're looking at the steps we took by Joe McHugh from the Joe and Charlie, and we're on step 11. I have the handout if you come. We read a few pages last week. It was great. Let's see, anything else? I've been writing thoughts on the steps, on the thoughts on recovery. If any of you read them and think they make sense or not, let me know, because they make sense to me, but it's hard when you're reading, writing it yourself. I wrote yesterday on what makes up self-will in step 4 and how that self-will is what we look at in step 4. Today we're finishing up Doctor's Opinion. We started the book again for the 10th time on Saturday. We got to XXX in the Doctor's Opinion. The more discussion meetings I go to, the more I sense, I don't know, it's just a sense, that most people don't understand what alcoholism is and the first step. And so Doctor's Opinion is really a powerful chapter. The first, actually 45 pages in Doctor's Opinion designed to tell us about our first step and what alcoholism really is. And in the Doctor's Opinion, we're going to finish the last few pages. And alcoholism is a spiritual disease that occurs when you're sober. When you're sober, all alcoholics have a separation from God, and we live on a self-centered life. We don't realize it. We can't see the truth from the false, and we decide what we need to be happy. And when we do that, we're self-will run riot, and we're full of resentment, fear, and we harm people. And when we do that, alcoholics don't like to feel bad. They don't like to feel uneasy. They don't like to feel isolated. And they seek the ease and comfort of alcohol. Because alcohol, they fix that. And their mind remembers that. Now, you could seek other things, too. There are other fellowships. But alcohol worked for a while, but it stopped working. The problem with alcohol for an alcoholic is that once we put it in our body, we want the second drink. And we can't control how much we drink, so we get in big trouble. And then we can't live sober without God. We don't have tools to live. And we keep getting irritable, restless, and discontent, and then we drink again. So we're screwed. We're screwed sober. People don't realize we all want to quit drinking, but we come here because we think we have a problem with alcohol, but our real problem is our separation from God. And I heard somebody say that they quit drinking 18 years ago. Makes sense, doesn't it? But I'm going to write the next thought on, I can't quit drinking. I don't have any power to make that decision that I quit drinking. But it's the grace of God by which I quit drinking. And I allowed God into me enough when I was defeated that I could have His grace. And then Richard and I were talking before the meeting, and I made this thought. It just came to me. I haven't thought about it a lot, but we start with the grace of God. And then as we work the steps, we have the relationship with God, and we have contact with God. And then that gives us even more power to live. And so that's what we're trying to do. On page XXX, he talks about, again, the phenomenon of craving. They hammer this home because a lot of alcoholics think that they can eventually drink normally, that they can find some way that they'll be able to control and enjoy his drinking. Remember, it says on that's the illusion that has to be smashed, delusion. He says there are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving, which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. And the phenomenon of craving only occurs after you take a drink. We're not talking about the obsession of the mind. And then he gives us examples of alcoholics. And I really questioned this when I read it, but now I think I understand what he's saying. It's probably the 100th time I've read it. He's talking about the classification of alcoholics and how people look before they took the first drink, and then they can't drink and they have the phenomenon of craving. And so we may all look a certain way, but then when we drink, we have the phenomenon of craving. And he talks about the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. They're not in this room, of course. They're always going on the wagons for keep, and they believe it, right? And they're over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. They can't take the first step. They can't see the hopelessness and futility of their life. Then there's the type who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He cannot admit he's powerless to control his drinking. Now, that you can do that in a lot of ways. You can say, it's not going to hurt me this time. Or I've been sober a long time, I can have one drink, right? The thinking of the alcoholic is endless, the rationalizations that can kill us. And he tries various ways of drinking, he changes his brand or environment. And there's the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he could take a drink without danger. Now, you have to remember, he was a physician. He wasn't an alcoholic. He would see these people come in. He would see the psychopaths come in. They're always coming in. They're always going to quit. They keep coming in week after week after week. And then he sees the type who are unable to admit that they can't drink, and they keep trying different ways of drinking, and they end up under his care in the hospital. And then he sees the type that was sober for a while and thought that they could control how much you drink. So it's the way he's seeing people who come into the hospital. There's the manic depressive type, who's the least understood, about whom a whole chapter can be written. And he says these are types they can appear entirely normal in every respect, but we're not looking at their mind. We're not talking about their thinking. We're just talking about how they look. You see, a guy looks normal, and then he keeps getting drunk every night and passed out and doing all sorts of horrible things. And they can't understand it, but it has to do with the phenomenon of craving. He says, all these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. Now, why is he hammering home this? Well, if alcoholics can't drink without the phenomenon of craving, they better learn how to live sober and not drink, because abstinence is the only treatment for the phenomenon of craving. So if you have the phenomenon of craving, you sit in this room and you know you're going to have more than one drink, you better learn how to live without drinking, right? And so they hammer that home, because a lot of people can't even see that. They can't understand, and I think there are people in a lot of alcoholics who don't understand the phenomenon of craving. They talk about they crave the next drink, and they're thinking about it in their mind, but that's not the physical craving. And it says this phenomenon is a manifestation of an allery which differentiates people. It sets us apart. So if you have the phenomenon of craving, you're an alcoholic. So if you've ever wanted more than one drink and couldn't stop, you're an alcoholic. Non-alcoholics stop. They wave their hands over the glasses. They tell the waiter they're starting to feel it. They've had enough. If you've ever had enough, you're not an alcoholic. Remember the warning that AA told them they should put on every bottle of alcohol. And because they asked AA, they wanted to put a warning label on alcohol. So they had the Congress had a meeting, a legislation a session on what we should put on alcohol bottles. And so AA says, I don't have any opinion. We don't have any opinion on anything, but we have a suggestion. You might want to put on this bottle, warning, this will run out. Alcoholics laugh at that. Not alcoholics don't even know what we're talking about. You know, whenever I was on the cruise, they had unlimited booze. And somebody would say, would you have a drink? And then my mind would immediately look at the bar and say, do they have enough in here? Non-alcoholics don't think that. Non-alcoholics don't worry on Friday about Sunday night. And so he says the only relief from this condition is entire abstinence. So they're telling you if you have an allergic reaction to penicillin and you break out in hives, you don't want to take any more penicillin. Now, I've never had a patient who came in and said, I'm allergic to penicillin, please write me a prescription and give me 100. It just doesn't happen. But we don't see that. Now, the reason we don't see that is because when we want a drink, our mind won't tell us about that. Our mind will only tell me what alcohol or drugs is going to do for me, not to me. And I block out the consciousness, the awareness that I can't have just one drink. And I may even tell myself with this insane mind that it's okay. Anybody ever do that? And so that's a problem in itself. That's sober. Our mind tells us it's okay to drink, and we have no willpower to keep from drinking. So that's why we have a hopeless condition without God, without the steps, without the program. We cannot, on our own power, ever control our drinking, and we never have the power of choice. So that's why I'm saying I can decide to quit, but I can't follow through on the decision. Did anybody else here decide to quit? Anybody take a solemn oath? Yeah, the solemn oath. And it made sense when you took it. And you know what? When we took the oath, I think we all believed it. Anybody have a plan for how they're going to quit, when they're going to quit? You know, they had a date. Alcoholics do that. It makes us feel good. I don't have to worry. It's Christmas. I'll drink because I'm going to quit on the 26th. But we can't follow through. And we're not bad people. We just don't have power. We think we're bad people. We're not. We don't have power to do that. And it says this immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. So here's a debate about how you keep alcoholics entirely abstinent. Now, when this book was written, and this was written in 1939, nobody understood the phenomenon of craving. He published this letter in the New England Journal for doctors, and they finally accepted this fact. They understood us. And they understood that our mind seeks the ease and comfort of alcohol, right? And when it does, nothing can come between us and that drink. And he says, the general opinion seems that we're doomed. I think most of us, we are doomed. Everybody in this room is doomed. And we don't realize it. Stu and I was talking, he went to see somebody who's dying of alcoholism. We don't talk about that enough. We're not grateful enough. We worry about silly things when we're sober and we're alive, right? We don't get back to the brass tactics that we're doomed. And I wrote, why? Because I cannot live without taking the first drink. I cannot live sober. And I have a spiritual disease. And when I straighten out spiritually, what does the book say? I straighten out mentally and physically. So what is the solution? How do you live sober? Perhaps I can answer this by relating one of my experiences. So he's going to finish this chapter by giving what he sees the solution by giving us someone's experience. And isn't that what the big book does? The big book gives us the solution to our alcoholism by showing their experience. So he says, 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had been partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. Boy, I hope I didn't have that. But it's bad. And what does that mean is that the people can't see any solution. They can't see any hope. They can't understand what's happening. You see it all the time when you talk to alcoholics in the hospital. You're wheeling them upstairs. How did I get this way? And he had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. So he understood his situation. Remember Bill W., we're going to read his story. Alcohol was my master. I was completely defeated. I was surrounded by quicksand. And people can share their moment when you knew there was no hope, when you couldn't fix this. Now, hopefully, when the person, and I know this for me, you can go through many stages of no hope, but there's some point when they call it hitting bottom, when I couldn't see any hope and I asked for help. I turned away from me and I said, God, help me. And so you can live with no hope for a long time, but if we live with that point where we can ask someone to help us and let God in, then we can start to get help. So he says, following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. So he's telling you the solution. This doctor who's worked with alcoholics is an expert on this, says that the solution is the plan outlined in this book. What could be a more powerful recommendation? Why? Because it has a plan to live sober and not take the first drink. So the solution is, we have a lot of solutions now that you hear about at meetings, but the solution for me is following the plan outlined in this book and living this plan. And if you can't live sober, try the plan in the book. And that's why we study this book, because I don't have another plan that I could follow that worked for me. I had plenty of plans. They were my plans, and they didn't work. And I think what our powerful birthday speaker this morning was sharing, that he doesn't want to listen to his plans anymore. He's going to listen to somebody else's plans because they're better than our plans. And in the beginning, that's humility. Are you willing to listen and follow directions? 1 year later, he called to see me and experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partially recognized his features, but their all resemblance ended. Anybody see that? You work with somebody, you see, remember the day they came in, they get their 1 year birthday, and they seem so different. It's a miracle. It's one of the greatest joys of AA is seeing the change in other people and walking the path with them. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. He was changed. He was a changed person. Remember, we need a personality change sufficient to overcome alcoholism. We have to change our attitudes and outlook on life, our old ideas. He said, I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I'd known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. Powerful testimony. Then here's another one. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient made his own diagnosis and, deciding his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had talked with me in which he frankly stated that he thought the treatment was a waste of effort. Sound familiar? Unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, then the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse. So people come in here and they want to know if it's going to work, and they want to know how it's going to look, and they want to be guaranteed, but they don't want to just give up and do the deal. And we can't tell them what's going to happen to them. We can only tell them what we did. And it says, if you want what we have and are willing to do what we did, then see what the result is. AA is not a book of telling you what you have to do. It's a book that suggests if you don't have any other plan, try this and tell us how it worked. And then your testimony is going to convince someone else to do the plan. And so this is their testimony. You don't have to like it. You don't have to agree with it. But it's what they did. You can't argue with it. That's why the book's so powerful. His alcoholic problem was so complex. And I wrote here, the future would have the willpower, and I wrote, God power to resist the impulse to drink. His alcohol problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology. And we doubted if even that would have any effect. I don't know what moral psychology was in those days, but it's an attempt to help the person see the situation and be able to figure it out with his own mind. He wrote, however, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. I wish I could make everybody become sold on the ideas contained in this book. Wouldn't that be great? And why do we have these meetings? And why? Because I hear Linda and everybody agreeing. Because it's been such a great, it's helped us. And we know it's a solution that'll work, but it's hard to convince somebody else to do it. He became sold. I like the idea. It's in quotations. When the idea is contained in this book, he has not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is as fine a specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. And then look up Scoff. Where's your book? There you go. Stu's going to help us out. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book. This is the guy who is the world expert on alcoholism. He had no solution. He wanted every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. Wow. And then we see his name here in the doctor's opinion. This is the fourth edition, but in the original book, he didn't put his name. And he did that because what he wrote wasn't really accepted completely by anybody in the medical profession. Scoff means scorn, mock, doubt, laugh at, poke fun at, or ridicule. Yep. If you come to enough meetings, you'll see people who will express that scoffing about what we're doing and the steps. And all they're really telling you is that they're not defeated yet and that they're not willing to let go and change their mind. So Silkworth put his name in the second edition, and he wrote this in the New England Journal, and then that became the disease concept of alcoholism that we think of. So powerful stuff. So then the book is going to take us to chapter one, which is Bill's story. But remember, it was chapter two in the original big book. And Bill W. wrote this chapter first. I don't have the original manuscript in here, but there are pages in there of his handwriting, of actually the how he wrote it, handwritten this. And he wrote this story with There's a Solution, and he sent this to the publisher when they decided to write a book in 1937, and then they got an advance from a publisher, which later fell through, and then they started their own publishing company, Works Publishing Company, and they sold stock to get the money to write the big book. I don't know if anybody ever get their money back from the stock originally, because they didn't sell many copies in 1939 when it came out. But eventually, in 1940, when they had the Rockefeller dinner and a few other things happened, and then 41, the Saturday Evening Post article, they began to sell copies of this book, and they sold about 8,000 copies in 1941. And Bill W. is writing this story, following the doctor's opinion, as a story of hope. This was a powerful story of hope and salvation to the world of alcoholism. And it's the more I read it, the more powerful I think it is. I can't imagine me sitting and writing this story. I don't know. God inspired this man. God picked many different people to carry his message throughout the whole history of mankind, and he picked this Bill W., and in particular to write this story. So remember, it starts out the foreword that we have a hopeless condition of mind and body, right? And this book is to show precisely what we have done to relieve it. And Bill's going to show someone who had this hopeless condition of mind and body, which we call alcoholism. And some people, when they read it, say, this is pretty good. But you have to read it and look at what he says in terms of how he thought, how Bill thought, how he acted, how alcohol dominated and changed his life, how he admitted defeat, how he was given the answer, and then how he worked the steps, and then what happened to him. And then it's powerful today because the man lived 36 more years after he wrote this. He lived 36 years after he quit drinking, maybe 37. And so he was able to stay sober and do this. And then the thing about Bill W., you know, you can criticize he was not perfect. He had a lot of character defects. He had issues. We all do. But the one thing that he had was such a powerful spiritual experience from his relationship with God that he couldn't help give it away. Now, I don't claim to be Bill W. I'm not. I don't. But I've had such a powerful spiritual experience doing these meetings, studying the book, that I can't help but do them. I mean, I just can't help myself. It's what I feel like God chose me. And Bill went through a lot to get this book written, to meet Dr. Bob, and then he was able to give us the traditions which have kept us together. So we'll read a few, just a few pages, and then we'll pick up with it next week. He was from New England. He actually was from Manchester, Vermont. And you've all heard of Dr. Bob from Akron. But Manchester, Vermont was the center of where God made his move. You know, it's like Bethlehem. Because he was from there. Lois Wilson became his wife, used to vacation there in the summers. Roland Hazard, who brought the answer to Ebbie Thatcher, used to vacation there in the summers. Ebbie Thatcher also went there. The key players that God put together to give us this book. So war fever ran high in New England town. This is World War I, to which we knew young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned. And we were flattered when the first citizens took us to their homes, making us feel heroic. So notice how he starts his story. Alcoholics all want to feel different. He felt heroic. He felt acceptance. He felt that he was okay because of the way he was seen as an officer. Now, would he have felt the same way if he was a private? See how alcoholics are? He wanted to feel differently than he did. And he wanted outside things, approval, to make him feel okay. Anybody relate to that? And so that's an alcoholic. We're never okay just being us with God. We have to be seen a certain way to feel a certain way. And guess what? It's never enough. So it starts out, here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last. In the midst of the excitement, I discovered at liquor. I think everybody's story is in these first few lines. We wanted love. We wanted applause. I don't know if I wanted to go to war. But I wanted to be part of life. Was any of you feel kind of on the outside looking in all the time? I never felt quite okay. Alcoholics, we have this longing for God. The separation from God is what Carl Jung says. And we never feel okay just being us, just in the moment. We need something to be okay, and it was alcohol. He discovered alcohol. I forgot the strong warnings. His grandfather raised him, believed that alcohol was evil and should not be drank, and the prejudice of my people concerning drink. In time, we sailed for over there. And then look at this. He's already part of life and everything's great. And then he's sailing and he's very lonely and again turned to alcohol. Why would he turn to alcohol if he was lonely? Did anybody do that? For what? The sense of ease and comfort, the sense of being okay, of belonging. So they landed in England. So the first paragraph is just tremendous. It shows you our whole disease and then it's never enough. And then you're still lonely, and you're still left with yourself and your mind, and you sought the ease and comfort of alcohol. So he landed in England. He visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, he wandered outside. My attention was caught by doggerel and an old tombstone. I actually tried to find it, but we were running late, and we've all got a higher power. And I was told we're not going to tromp around in the there. You know, we'd been tromping all day, and... She's wonderful. We never did get to see it. But I think you can find it. I think there's a map. It says, here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is near forgot whether he dieth by musket or by pot. That's not marijuana, but pot isn't in the big book. And it says, ominous warning which I failed to heed. And then he talks about this. When he was in the cathedral, he felt much moved. He wanted to see God. And he says, I remembered this tombstone, because you'll see it later in his story, how when he finds God, he remembers that moment, looking at the tombstone, feeling this much moved, wanting this connection with God. And then he leaves there. He didn't heed the warning. And then he's going to talk about what happened. So the first five pages in this book are Bill's kind of where alcohol is working and then it stops working. Then pages 5 to 8 is where he really hits the complete defeat. Then pages 9 through 12 is where he is able to change his mind about God. And then 12 to the end is where he works the steps. And I think that could be the sequence of all alcoholics, if you think about it. So I'm just going to read this last paragraph and then shut up. 22 at a veteran of foreign... You're hopeful, right? 22 at a veteran of foreign wars. I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader. He was feeling good about herself. Why? Because the men of the battery give me a special token of appreciation. Here's, he has a talent for leadership. And what's that going to do? It's not going to be of service to God and others, right? It's going to imagine, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurance. So he'll be even more fancy. And he'll get more approval based on how the world sees him. So the vision for Bill, to give him self-esteem, make him feel okay, how he would be seen, was to be a success and to run enterprises. We'll see how that worked for him. Remember, the ego is never satisfied. You never get enough. So his instincts for life, for Bill to be okay, was to achieve all these things on the outside. And we'll pick up with that next week. Somebody remember where it was so I don't review the whole chapter again.